Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 21st of January. This hour of the program, President Obama's rather feisty State of the Union address last night. He talked about many issues, enhancing tax credits for education and child care, new taxes and fees on high-income earners. He spoke a lot about capital gains taxes and taxes on large financial institutions. We're going to center on the economic portion of his address last night and ask whether or not what he proposed has any chance of going anywhere. The State of the Union was given one day after. I find this absolutely amazing. This Oxfam report, did you see this on Monday, that looked at the global elite? It warned that the richest 85 people across the globe share a combined wealth as much as the poorest 3.5 billion of the world's population. So that puts this conversation in context, and we'll ask our guest about that figure as well. Chuck Maher is with us this hour, Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 1999 to 2004, he was Economic Policy Advisor to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle and Senior Advisor for Budget Policy at the National Economic Council from 97 through 99 during the second term of President Clinton. He was also chief economist of the Senate Budget Committee and a professional staff member of the Senate Banking Committee. Before we talk to him about all the ideas that the president put forward last night, let's hear just a little bit from the president himself during last night's State of the Union address.
At every step, we were told our goals were misguided or too ambitious, that we would crush jobs and explode deficits. Instead, we've seen the fastest economic growth in over a decade, our deficits cut by two-thirds, a stock market that has doubled, and healthcare inflation at its lowest rate in 50 years. So the verdict is clear. Middle-class economics works. Expanding opportunity works. And these policies will continue to work as long as politics don't get in the way. I still believe that together we can do great things, even when the odds are long. I believe this because over and over in my 6 years in office, I have seen America at its best.
We'll be welcoming phone calls for Chuck during this hour. Many of you, I'm sure, watched or listened to the State of the Union address. What stood out in your mind? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hello, Chuck. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, good afternoon, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. I think the president should have mentioned that Oxfam report. That just is incredible. 85 people own as much wealth as 3.5 billion of the world's population. That's phenomenal.
Yeah, it's stunning. It's hard to get your arms around. I mean, I think
yes.
If you just look here in the United States, you know, the fact that really hits me is that the top 400 people in the United States, the president talks about capital gains, right, appreciation of assets. In the United States, the top 400 people, we're talking about a country of 300 million, one of every $6 of capital gains flows to just that top 400.
Mm. And yet this is going to be a tough sell, what he outlined last night concerning capital gains, isn't it?
It is, because you do have, within the political system, the top 400 and folks like that do have a fair amount of political power. So there'll certainly be pushback. But I think the president has made a pretty clear case on this big loophole here on capital gains, because it is really hard to defend, right? If you think about middle-class people, they get their paychecks every week. They pay income tax out of that. They pay payroll taxes. But then, capital gains are treated very differently. Capital gains are not taxed every year, really. They're just taxed when a person sells an asset, and they have this loophole that allows capital gains. If one holds the capital gain for one's entire life, the tax liability is just completely wiped out. And obviously, average people don't get to do that on their taxes. So I think he has pointed to that. Again, it would be difficult over time to do it, but I think he has really highlighted, what is a glaring loophole.
What was the capital gains tax rate during the Reagan era, Chuck?
It was 28%, And so the president is proposing basically just to bring it back to that level. It had been cut during the Clinton and Bush years. So he's just restoring it. And that's obviously 28%. It would be a little bit higher than it is now, but it still would be favorable compared to the top income tax rate on labor income.
Mm-hmm. And let's amplify this a little bit. If you hold on to all of those assets and your growth keeps growing and growing and growing, those who would take your money or you pass it along to future generations don't have to pay any tax on that now. Is that right?
So the way it works, right, so if you have a capital gain and you haven't, say you buy a stock worth $1 million, right, in the first 10 years it grows to $2 million, right? So it doubles, and if a person sells it, then they'd pay a gain on that $1 million gain, $2 million minus $1 million. And they'd pay the, you know, rate less than their wages, but they'd pay the 28% the president proposes. But if one holds it for one's entire life, right, then it grows to like $10 million. So you're sitting, the person is sitting on a $9 million gain, and say they're 75 years old. If they sell it while they're still alive, they would pay the tax on that $9 million. Whereas once they die, that $9 million gain is wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
So the person coming behind that would actually, if they sold it the next day, would pay no capital gains tax on that.
How important would this change in capital gains be for the president to fund all of the other things that he's talking about, child care, paid sick leave, maternity leave, lower mortgage premiums? Are they really tied together? You have to have one or you can't have any of the other?
Well, I think, you know, that depends on how it all sort of plays out. One could find other offsets for those, but he did, you know, I think he did in a sort of fiscally responsible way, say, you know, these are my priorities, these are the middle-class things I'd like, and the working-class things I'd like to do, and I would pay for them this way. And so it's pretty much, you know, the package, the capital gains provisions and the rate and this loophole, plus the tax on the largest financial institutions, that would pay for all those priorities he laid out in child care, in education, community college, things like that.
Mm-hmm. You have written about, and tell me this: how this happened, that the typical family would have $10,000 more in income absent the great income shift since 1979. What's happened since 79?
Yeah. So I think this is the most important, Kathleen, about this speech, right? The clip that you played, the president has basically said that we faced the sort of biggest crisis, economic crisis we faced since World War II in the last 6 years. And the United States aggressively attacked that. It's been extremely painful. But now we've sort of come out of that, and the crisis is over, right? The unemployment rate has dropped back. The financial markets have recovered. And so now he's sort of turning the page. I think this is going to be the long-lasting effect of this speech because it does sort of shift the debate. And what he's shifting it to is more this underlying issue, right, which really is the fundamental challenge that policymakers face, is that since the mid-70s, you've had a break in sort of the fundamental relationship in the economy between productivity gains and living standards. And so what happened is that for various reasons, you know, average people, employees, have become just weaker. And what's happened is as the economy has grown, more and more of the growth has flowed up the income scale, and sort of people in the bottom and the middle have done less well. And so what that number shows, if you think about how income was, share of incomes based back in 1979 and how the economy has grown since then, if everybody had grown at a certain, at the same rate, with kept up with growth, kept up with productivity, right, mm-hmm. those families in the middle would have $11,000 more today than they actually do, because all that growth really has flowed to the top. And so it's over several decades, but it just shows how substantial really the polarizing incomes have been.
And the reasoning behind allowing the growth to go up the income scale was what? What would be the economic benefit to everybody?
Well, it hasn't been a benefit. It's just been the result of various factors in the economy, right? It's a globalization effect, right, where you have all of a sudden, you have the world labor market increases. You have, you know, you have the fall of the Soviet Union. So then you have the Chinese, the Indian economy, all sort of becoming more and more part of the global labor force. You have technology changes, and you also have just a cultural change within corporations, which I think has now. I think people are starting to sort of think about it. But you really have had this several decades of really focus on sort of quarterly profit, sort of shareholder value as the only sole goal of a corporation. And so in all those things, sort of average workers have kind of lost some power. And that's really has flowed through, and then their living standards have been hit by that. And so I think the president is sort of, you know, the political process, the debate is trying to come to grips with that. How can that be changed? What can we do on the tax front, right? How important it is to get unemployment rate down as low as can be borne, to get to full employment, to get wages going, right? Is there things that within corporations should change? So I think this is where I think the debate is heading, and I think this speech is kind of a marker towards that.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been a long time coming. 79 wasn't yesterday. Hasn't there been some more attention paid to this issue?
No question. And I think it has, you know, ebbed and flowed, right? I mean, I think, you know, back when President Clinton was in power in 93, right, you had a very, you know, similar. He did have higher taxes on upper-income people, and he has, you know, instituted and expanded things like we can talk about, but the earned income tax credit, right?
Mm-hmm.
You do have provisions in the tax code that actually have been growing since 80s. You know, President Reagan supported, President Bush, President Clinton, all the way through. So there have been some things done, and it's tremendously effective. But the forces that are up against are very tough. But like right now, President Obama has a proposal to help expand the earned income tax credit for childless workers, the one group the federal government taxes into poverty, the one group that's left out, and it just happens to be the exact same proposal that Paul Ryan has. So there is, you know, there is some hope here. These things have been happening, but again, the forces that they're up against are very strong.
Unless I'm hearing them incorrectly, it appeared to me that Senator Joni Ernst's response called for a simplification of the tax process. It almost sounds like they're calling for some kind of flat tax, which she indicated would be beneficial to all. Is that the direction the Republicans are going?
Well, you do often see Republicans, you'll hear the word flatter often, right, to flatten the rate structure. And that sort of is a code word for lowering that top rate down. And I think, you know, again, I think that the president worked hard to get the top rate back to, you know, to 39.6%, back to where it was when President Clinton was in office. So I think that there's going to be some reluctance to do that. But you do see, you do have some partisan differences on what the priority should be.
Let's focus on some of his early remarks last night. He talked about all the good from the past 6 years, looked at the state of the economy 7 years ago. He did say, talked about 10 million people being insured, more are being insured. The deficit, he said, and I'm wondering if this is true, the deficit has been cut by two-thirds, and wages are finally, he said, starting to rise. Are they?
Yes, and finally so, right? Because obviously when the crisis hit in the depths of recession and you have unemployment go so high, you know, firms are looking to lay off people and obviously cut wages. So now we're getting to the point where the economy has recovered enough jobs have come back, the unemployment rate has fallen to such a level that finally the demand for labor is such that you're starting to get at least some hints of wage growth, but obviously very, very, very small to begin with, but at least a decent sign. But I think, you know, again, he underscored the health care. I mean, this is, you know, when we look back historically at President Obama's presidency, that should be, you know, one of the signature achievements, obviously, is getting, you know, more and more closer to universal health coverage, which has been, you know, missing part of the social insurance system for decades.
And I believe he mentioned that the inflationary rate when it comes to health care is lower than it has been in 50 years. Has that been checked? Is that true?
Yeah. So this is, you know, it's still, you're sort of coming out of this weak environment. So the question is whether it's sustainable. But you have had quite the shift in health costs. The health inflation really has become much more contained, and that is really a break from the past. And if you look out, you know, years down the road, the U.S. faces long-term fiscal pressure for two basic reasons, right? The country's getting older, and because of this health inflation. And so a lot of the long-term debt projections, which sort of years ago seemed to be unsustainable, were really driven by these health inflation numbers. So we'll see how, if it continues, but this is, the last few years have been extremely hopeful on that front, and hopefully a break from the past where you really did, you know, where health inflation every year just eclipsed overall inflation, was really putting upward pressure because the government obviously does spend quite a bit of money, right, on health care for old people, disabled people. So it could be tremendously beneficial to the government's finances and to, you know, to average people, obviously, and to companies.
Chuck Maher is our guest this hour. We're looking at President Obama's State of the Union address and the theme of the address, middle class economics. What did you think about what he said, the policies that he outlined that addressed middle class economics? What do you think about the chances of any of this passing a Republican House and Senate? We certainly welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Chuck was economic policy advisor to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle and also senior advisor for budget policy at the National Economic Council during the second term of President Clinton, and tax policy, of course, key responsibility of those positions. He also, earlier in his career, was chief economist of the Senate Budget Committee and a professional staff member of the Senate Banking Committee. Lines are open for you right now. We'll welcome your phone calls, 800-486-8655. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're looking at the president's State of the Union address, and particularly those parts of the address that looked at middle-class economics. 800-486-8655. Craig in Onalaska is our first caller. Hi, Craig.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I have a question on the capital gains for people that are retired. Millions of Americans have their IRAs and either stocks or mutual funds, and would this hurt the average American?
No, it doesn't. So the way it works, if you think about retirement accounts, middle-class people have most money in IRAs and 401ks, and the way, you know, 401k retirement plan works is that the person puts the money in generally on a tax-free basis, and the capital gains accrue over time. And then for like a 401k, there is a sort of rules on distributions, that the money needs to be paid out by a certain age, and that money faces is taxed at ordinary income rates. So those do not change. What we're talking about here is money that's invested in a, you know, brokerage account or real estate that's owned, and it's the capital gains that accrue to those on those assets. And again, there's built-in large exemptions for, you know, $100,000 per person, but it's really getting at the capital gains of, you know, very, very wealthy investors.
Thanks, Craig. Jennifer in Madison. Hi.
Hi. That previous call was the perfect setup for my comment. I think that it's been too easy for members of Congress to get the public all upset about tax increases because, you know, this will affect me, my hard-earned money. And I think it's really important in the case of capital gains to make the case and let people know this isn't hard-earned money. This kind of capital gains only goes to people who already have a fair amount of money, and they buy something and then they get more money back. It's not like, you know, what the rest of us go through to earn our keep.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, again, that the different types of income are taxed differently, and capital gains enjoys advantages that paychecks don't, right? The fact that you don't pay the tax until you sell an asset, whereas, you know, obviously in a paycheck, one pays tax, is taxes withheld every week or every, you know, 2 weeks when you get paid. So I think it is very different, and it sort of is tilted in favor of capital gains, and the president is just trying to correct that tilt a bit.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, thanks very much for your call. Email from Jim in Madison, who says, one of the big contributors to income inequality are free trade agreements and outsourcing. That was something that was never scrutinized. He says, I regret voting for Obama in 2008. If he's thinking of setting the Democrats up for 2016, he's delusional. With a turnout of 34% last November, dream on.
Right. Trade is definitely a controversial topic, and The president is trying to conclude this agreement in the Pacific with the Pacific countries, and that will certainly get a tough response depending on how it goes. It could be rather controversial issue this year, because it is one that you could see some overlap between the president and the Republicans in Congress and some Democrats, but you'll have a mix there, because trade obviously has got some very big benefits to it, right? Independent world, we sell things, other countries sell things. Overall, the country benefits from that, but the benefits are not broadly broadly shared, and you do have losers. And so trade is very much a hot topic.
The president mentioned a couple. These are side issues, but they're important issues. I didn't realize there were this many people who had no paid sick leave. 43 million Americans,
yeah.
No paid sick leave. He talked about that, helping states adopt paid sick leave. He talked again about raising the minimum wage, which is quite popular in this country. Why are there so many people with no paid sick leave?
Yeah, I thought that was tremendous. I mean, I think, you know, we tend, especially I've living inside the Beltway, I will say the policymakers, I think there is are often very, very, just out of touch with how sort of low-income people live,
mm-hmm.
and the kind of jobs they have and what they face on the job. The things, you know, I know personally, I take for granted. You know, if my daughter gets sick, I take her to the doctor. Right. If she has a recital, you know, she plays the viola, you know, I leave in time to get there. You know, I do these things without even second thoughts. Right. If I get sick, I go to the doctor. But for low income people, a lot of, you know, retail jobs, a lot of food service jobs, which were, you know, home health jobs, where low income people work, who, you know, perform very important jobs. They're treated very differently. Like often, you know, they have to decide between taking their kid to the doctor or losing their job. Right, they don't get to take a sick day, and so I think, you know, it's a very small step. It seems like it should be such a given that everyone expects to get sick leave, but a lot of people just they don't have it, and so I think there's recognition of that, and I think there, you know, is slowly recognition that, you know, the employees have become so weak that you do have pretty tough conditions for people who work, and then there are, you know, there are millions of them.
40 years ago, he mentioned 65% of workers were eligible for overtime. Today, it is just 11% of workers. What happened?
Yeah, you do have a shift in jobs, and there is a issue of categorization. He's trying to bring that back a bit. But, you know, they do have the economy shifting, you know, from sort of manufacturing towards sort of service-based economy, more and more part-time workers, right? You do have these shifts that have affected pay and benefits.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that he looked at, and he put it front and center, and it made me want to do a show on child care that was available because so many women went in the workforce during World War II. I'm interested in learning the history of that. But he talked about affordable, high-quality child care. What were there economic measures that he mentioned in the address last night that would pay for that, which can be quite expensive? And it's so important, and we haven't addressed that in this country for a long time.
Right, right. And so that falls into the same grouping of the loophole in the capital gains as far as paying for it.
I see.
Yeah, so there's two key provisions there, a couple things that he's talking about. And he's basically recognizing that for, you know, working and middle-class families, particularly the two earners, that there's a hurdle for the, you know, either the mom or the dad to go to be the second one to go to work, right? Because the cost of child care is extremely high. And if you look at the sort of the literature on taxes, right, the one sort of type of person that actually is somewhat tax sensitive is a second earner in a married couple, because they sort of can face higher rates, but also because of these child care costs, you combine taxes with the child care costs, with commuting costs, and all of a sudden, to a lot of, you know, moms at home and now increasingly dads at home, right, that it feels like the break-even point is just too high. And so the president is trying to address that by saying, let's make child care more affordable. Let's increase the credit, particularly for the youngest kids below 5, because their child care is the most expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And also he has this credit for second earners to try to reduce the tax rate that they face coming into the labor force. Because, you know, just from a pro-growth, right? You don't want the tax code and child care costs to keep people from working who would like to work, right? We all would benefit with that greater production. And so he's trying to reduce the hurdle to get into the labor force.
I think he mentioned that good quality child care can cost as much as a year's time at the University of Minnesota.
I can attest to that, yes. Yeah. Child care is very expensive, right? Because you're talking about child in tends to be in a setting where the ratio of children to care is relatively low, so you need to pay the salary. So it is very expensive, and obviously it's important to get good quality child care. And again, hopefully with more support, you can get also have people have access to better child care than they otherwise would.
Our guest is Chuck Maher, Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and we are examining the President's State of the Union address last night, particularly his ideas that look at the middle class and middle class economics. He called for a number of proposals that would look at child care, that looked at all kinds of issues that would make life easier, paid sick leave for the middle class, and how this would be funded would be raising the capital gains tax to 28%, which Democrats remind people was what was in place during the Reagan era. And it would help finance a set of tax breaks for middle-income families. It would do away with this thing that happens with capital gains, that if you hold on to it for your life and you pass along that money to your heirs, that the money is not taxed. It would also include on the big banks, tax on big banks in this country. It would appear to be going nowhere, although you got the Republicans in the House and in the Senate. We're going to hear in just a moment part of the Republican response from new senator from Iowa, Senator Joni Ernst. And this would indicate that the Republicans have no intention of going along with any of this, but we will see. So what do you think of what the president had to say last night, of his outline of proposals, and particularly how this would be paid for? Would you agree with it? Do you think that it's not a good idea? Would you be more in favor of a different kind of tax on everybody? What do you make of the fact that this income inequality has really, really been brought home with, we've heard these reports before, but here it is in black and white, Oxfam's report on Monday that the richest 85 people in the world now have as much wealth as the poorest $3.5 billion of the world's population. How do you take that in? What does that mean? We have phone lines open, so join us. 800-486-8655 is the number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Let's hear a bit of the Republican response from last night and ask our guest what this may indicate, if there's any room for any kind of compromise.
Americans have been hurting, but when we demanded solutions too often, Washington responded with the same stale mindset that led to failed policies like Obamacare. It's a mindset that gave us political talking points, not serious solutions. That's why the new Republican majority you elected started by reforming Congress to make it function again. And now we're working hard to pass the kind of serious job creation ideas you deserve. Let's simplify America's outdated and loophole-ridden tax code. Republicans think tax filing should be easier for you, not just the well-connected. So let's iron out loopholes to lower rates and create jobs, not pay for more government spending. The president has already expressed some support for these kinds of ideas. We're calling on him now to cooperate to pass them.
Senator Joni Ernst giving the Republican response, one of many Republican responses. When she talked about closing loopholes that would lower rates and the Democrats having shown some interest in that, what is she talking about? Do you know?
Yes, I mean, part of that is related, something like the capital gains. I'm not sure she'd be for that specific one. But I think there is recognition on the Republican side that there are kind of loopholes and sort of tax subsidies at the top end of the income scale that are very generous and that they would agree to trim back. I think where the difference comes is what to do with that money, right? I think what she's implying, right, I think a lot of Republicans would like to take whatever loophole closures or reductions in tax subsidies and applying that to lowering the top tax rate on the highest income people. And I think what the president is saying is that, well, that really shouldn't be our highest priority, because if we look back, you know, over these decades, what we've seen is that the highest income people have done so well, and that we really need to focus our energy on working class, middle class people whose living standards have not done as well. And so I think that's really where the difference comes.
Jean is our next caller, in Menominee. Hi, Jean.
Hi. Yes, let's flatten the Social Security taxes and have it apply to all earned and unearned income. That would lower the tax rates for both the businesses that hire people and the employees themselves, because you get a whole lot more money with a whole lot lower rate when if it were applied to all earned and unearned income.
Chuck.
Right. So I think, you know, that is that's a constructive comment. I think, Gene, I think that was done somewhat to a degree on the Medicare tax. Right? The Medicare tax has been applied to is not capped like the Social Security tax, and now for the first time also applies to capital income, and that was a big change, a big part of the health care bill. I think Social Security, there's an issue that the taxes are tied to the benefits, right? But I do think that once the issue of Social Security is engaged, you will see an effort. And I think that there should be an effort, really, to raise that cap or to get that cap up higher so you do get it up a little higher up on the income scale. Because right now, obviously, for very high-income people, you know, Social Security taxes are actually very low because the cap is a very small fraction of their income.
Lou in Duluth. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Real quick, I think the main problem why we won't see very much movement on paid leave, paid sick leave, paid vacation for the common person on the lower rungs is because of greed. That corporate higher-ups want to make sure that they have their pockets filled first, and, you know, if they lose one person on the lower rung, well, they can get two more just like them. You know, it's really corporate that needs to set the example and say, hey, look, all my people are important. You know, let's look after everyone, and we'll have good workers. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you, Lou.
Yeah. All right, I think it depends on the company. Obviously, you have, like I think it's like Costco. It has, you know, tremendous benefits for its workers. So I think it does depend on the company. I think it also depends on what the unemployment rate is, which is so important, right? So important for the government to have a priority of full employment, where there is much more competition for workers, so workers have more of an influence. But I completely agree that, you know, we have reached this point where employees, particularly in these lower income occupations, have, you know, very, very little power. And there has been this tilt. And I think it's to almost a ridiculous level now. If you think about, you know, people who work in food service, you know, coffee shops, right? This almost an idea that it's almost like just-in-time labor, right? It's like come in, you know, for a couple hours in the morning, but then when the crowds die down, why don't you go home? Maybe we'll call you back. Come in later on tomorrow. They don't know their schedule. You know, how does anyone, you know, live like that and try to raise children like that? And I think so. The pendulum really has swung pretty far in a direction against these folks. So hopefully we'd like to see it, you know, switch back.
How many of the ideas that the president proposed last night can he take on, as he did with immigration and climate change recently, with executive action? Anything?
There could be some regulatory action around the banks, possibly, maybe some of the overtime, some of the labor issues, but most of these really are are changes in tax laws. I mean, that does require a law.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Lou, for your call. A couple lines are open for you. Our number is 800-486-8655. Marshall in Madison. Hi.
Hi. About a year ago, I think it was this show that had a guest on that talked about the benefits of childhood education and child care. And the guest talked about really the challenges lie in the number of parents that are home for kids these days and really alarming rates of births to single moms that are out there. And that, you know, the children that these women are having really don't develop their brains very well because, you know, if there's just one parent at home, they've got half the number of people talking to them, and there's studies that show that the kids' brains really take off from that point. So with that kind of data that the country has and the condition that we're in, how, you know, I understand that our president wants to take money from people that are well off to pay for child care for these folks that haven't all these babies. But how does that make any sense if, in fact, that having somebody else raise your child doesn't really work and doesn't help out, and it's just a perpetuating the cycle of perhaps those people having to work and that labor force that you're so alarmed at is so huge?
Okay, well, I think there's a few things in there, but I think there's no question that all the research shows how critical the early life, you know, 0 to 3, 0 to 5, how critical that is to brain development, health, and to someone's the child's life as they go on. And obviously, you know, it's important when kids are in elementary school as well. But I think there's great research on quality care, but also on income support for low-income people. We have some emerging research on the earned income tax credit, the child tax credit, that says if we do give more support for these low-income families, more income, right, rewarding their work, that actually we see benefits from the birth weight of babies. We see better development. We see higher, better school performance in elementary education, more likely to go to college, and actually do better as an adult and work harder. So there's no question that intensive efforts, income support for lower income families, more higher quality child care, and also giving people the options to either to have parents stay home or to be able to have access to high quality care is critical.
Mm-hmm. Well, how many parents can stay home, whatever your income level is now? This is a whole different world. Everybody works.
Exactly. And this is why, again, people need to have access to good care.
Right.
And be rewarded for the work that they do, because kids, you know, just how they fare in life is dependent on how well their parents are doing and what is available in the home, access to health care, good food.
Let's go next to Rick in Oshkosh. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Joy. I'm a retired community college professor out of Illinois, and what we did some years ago when I was still active there is a new president came in and we established our daycare center right on campus, just right outside of one of our main rooms where students and faculty and staff could bring their youngsters and leave them there during the day, and they could run back and forth and check on the kids while they were in school and things of that sort. We were able to get some federal grants and some state aid to build those buildings. We provided an opportunity for education majors to go over and get some experience working with the youngsters at that time, to the point whereby now that I'm retired, I've noticed they have actually created, you know, we used temporary buildings to start with, but it's now a permanent facility which handles upwards of 200 youngsters. So it's been a really big advantage there, and I'm strongly in favor of that particular program.
Yeah.
All of my own grandchildren have gone to schools mm-hmm. like this, and it has definitely been an advantage to them.
Yeah, I mean, how great would it be if that were more universal? I mean, just think from a parent, you know, especially a low-income parent that has to take buses. I mean, just going from, you know, trying to get to the drop off at the one center and then try to get to your job, I mean, to be able to have it, you know, close to your workplace, be able to check on your kids, the sort of the comfort of that, I mean, that sounds terrific.
I would have thought by now that so many companies would have instituted child care or combined their resources and had child care centers in buildings in cities all over the country, and it really hasn't happened.
Well, I think it depends. I mean, I think some of the larger companies, you know, more forward-looking have done that. But you're right, I think you'd find quite a different situation in some of the, you know, if you go to Scandinavian countries, they probably do child care quite a bit different.
We continue our conversation. We're looking at the President's State of the Union address and particularly focusing on middle class economics and all of the policies that he outlined that pay attention to middle class economics, paid sick leave, raising the minimum wage, lowering mortgage premiums, looking at being eligible for overtime, and access of course, to education. We did a show on Free Community College last week, and how all of this would be funded, which would be reducing the capital gains, raising the capital gains tax to 28% and making income taxable capital gains once a person died and was leaving money to an heir. And Chuck is our guest, Chuck Marr. He's Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He was economic advisor to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle for several years and has done many other high-level Washington, D.C. government positions dealing with the economy. More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Chuck, here's an email that has come in from Jane. Paid sick leave is not a right. It's a benefit that your employer can offer you. If you don't like the benefits offered to you, go find a job at a place that offers it. The same with vacation. As far as child care, why should the American taxpayer be footing somebody's babysitting bills? You have children and you decide to go to work. Hey, I'd like someone to buy me a car to get to work. Is that going to be the next benefit that Uncle Sam is going to dictate?
Right. So, and paid sick leave. I think it's just the norm, right? The economy is going to be the sort of policy will be driven to get the economy to a level where most people have a job. So we'd like to get those jobs to be good jobs, to be decent paying jobs, and to have decent benefits. So we very much like to have a cultural norm that there is paid sick leave, that people get a decent amount of vacation. And right now, we don't have that. The same way with the minimum wage, right? If we didn't have the minimum wage, a lot of folks would be making less money. So you have this sort of balance between sort of regulatory efforts by the government. And this is one where we find that people, you know, unlike most upper middle class people, do not have a basic sick leave, and it makes it very difficult for them to take their children to the doctor. And here the president says, well, that really is not the right thing. We really need to have the shift, put the spotlight on this, and everyone should have sick leave. So I think that's an excellent proposal. And as far as the child care, I think you need to think about it from society. We need to have a productive workforce and have the economy produce to its full potential, and it's very efficient both for the people themselves, but also for the economy, to make it easier for people to join the workforce. Right? You don't want to set up hurdles that keep people from working and contributing. So it does make sense actually for the economy and for society to subsidize childcare.
Jim Rice Lake, hello.
Yes, I was just commenting. I think in the last couple of years since the Citizens United ruling by the Supreme Court, which says that corporations are people for purposes of expression and spending of money. I mean, we've seen a ground shift in our political environment in the Walker recall campaign and his most recent campaign. We have Wisconsin, allegedly a progressive state, on the cusp of right to work. People with power don't give it up readily. If this keeps progressing, aren't we going to see the model of America for 2020 being 1920? Meaning a capitalist ownership class and a servant class. That's my question. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks for the call, Chuck.
I mean, I think you do see what has been shown is that the debate in Washington and outside in governments generally does tend to reflect disproportionately the sort of issues that more affluent people care about it because they're very, very politically active. Right? If you think about a politician, what a politician does in a given day, a lot of that is fundraising, raising money. So there's just a tremendous amount of contact between political office holders and very high-income people. And that does affect sort of what is the discussion, which is we talk about the sick leave. You know, a lot of, you know, policymakers really probably don't know that most people don't have, that so many people don't have access to sick leave. So it really is very important, obviously, to open up the conversation and to shift the debate and try to put the focus on, you know, how actually average people live, working class people, low income people live. And I think that's really what the president tried to do. And I think, you know, was effective in putting a spotlight on some of these things that are just for people, you know, sitting around kitchen tables that are everyday big issues, childcare, access to college, retirement, health care.
When we talked, Stu sent an email and wanted to know when the president was addressing middle class economics, How do we define middle class? What does it mean in today's world?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's middle class, and it's also people striving to get into the middle class, right? So I think it's, in the United States, most it's such a wide swath of people, right? But what he's talking about is, you know, that from sort of the minimum wage worker up to a pretty, you know, reasonably happy, upper middle class person, the people that, you know, that go to work every day, that have to worry about caring for their children, sending their kids to college, trying to buy a house, and trying to have a decent retirement, right? It's just the broad swath of the country, right? And he's trying to say that, in contrast, in recent decades, you know, most of the economic growth has flowed really to a very, very small sliver of society. It really has flowed to the very, very top. So I think it's a pretty broad definition. I think it's middle class, but I think it also includes people sort of striving to get into the middle class.
Earl is next in Medford. Hi, Earl.
Hello. Great show. I'm talking about a fair tax system, and then I hear that less and less money is going to the IRS every year from Congress. What is Congress doing there?
Yeah, it's a great point, and I think it's just no other word to say, but it's just disgrace, right? I mean, I think there's been this effort just to defund the IRS, and I just think it's so short-sighted. What they've done in the last 5 years is basically cut funding by about a fifth overall budget, and also for enforcement. So for honest taxpayers, you know, your chances of getting through on a phone call are just greatly diminished. You call the IRS, they put you on hold for 30 minutes, and then they tell you, well, we got to hang up on you, right? You can't get through. And then for people who cheat on their taxes, right, they're trying to gut the enforcement budget. And I think it's a very sad state, and, you know, the president, the head of the IRS has been trying to turn it around, and they have an advocate for the taxpayers, been trying to highlight this as a problem. But Republicans, you know, one of their main priorities in recent years has been to defund the IRS. And we're going to see in this tax season, you have the health care changes coming online. It's going to be very difficult filing season because the IRS, they have just really cut that budget so dramatically that they're overwhelmed and, you know, they can't even answer the telephone.
I've heard they're way behind with getting your forms, et cetera, your refunds.
Yeah, and I think it is really stressed right now. And it is, you know, it's just a direct result of really large budget cuts. And it's penny wise, pound foolish, right? Because the IRS is one of the only agency in the government where you give it, you know, the budget actually creates, you know, increases revenue because every dollar the IRS is given, you get back about $6.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think? Some of this will pass, or it was just a good speech?
I think there's a chance. Like the one thing which has been the proposal, which he just sort of alludes to, but in the tax area, the most important thing right now is you have these improvements to the child tax credit and the earned income tax credit, which for a minimum wage mom, you know, health worker making $15,000 is worth $1,700, and those improvements in the child tax credit, earned income tax credit, are really what I would say the top priorities this year to get done. The president has put a priority on that. I'm hoping in whatever tax bill he gets with Paul Ryan that will be included. So I think something like that has a chance. And again, on these childless workers, right? You have the exact same proposal from President Obama and Paul Ryan. You know, hopefully that has a possibility. But I think more broadly, what this does do, I think, is it will set. It begins to start the conversation of the presidential election, right? That each candidate is going to feel the need to sort of engage on this working class, middle class living standards.
Chuck, thank you very much for being with us this hour. I appreciate it.
All right, Kathleen, I enjoyed it.
Chuck Maher, Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He was economic advisor to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle. As well. And we thank him for taking a look at the economic parts, and there were many of them, of the President's State of the Union address last night. News is coming up momentarily. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And we will continue and look at American folk life. Stephen Wade joins us hour two.